Well, good afternoon. I'm Kurt Dewhurst. I'm the Director of Arts and Cultural Initiatives for University Outreach and Engagement and a curator here at the MSU Museum and Director Emeritus of the MSU Museum. And I want to just welcome you to what we think will be a very special opportunity. This particular program, this conversation has really been developed in conjunction with two exhibitions. I hope you've had a chance to visit the exhibitions. If not, I urge you to do so. One exhibition is Ahmed Kathrada, a South African activist for non-racialism and democracy. And the other is Ruby Bridges, Brown versus Board of Education, and the Greater Lansing Sites of Conscience Project. I'm not going to take time to talk about those here, but I do hope you'll take some time to read about them and get involved in using them, sharing with them with others. I also want to acknowledge the support of the MSU Office of Inclusion for these exhibitions and the related programs, including today's conversation. The conversation today is designed to compare and contrast the liberation struggle in South Africa with the U.S. civil rights movement. The invited participants will explore these connections in keeping with the 60-50 thematic year linking the exploration and study with commemoration and remembrance, intertwined with a multitude of cultural expressions focused on civil and human rights. I hope you've taken part in some of these. If not, I urge you to keep watching for 60-50. John Beck is here as one of the coordinators of the project. I'm lucky enough to also to serve on the steering committee. We're kind of amazed, if you haven't been to the website, of all the activities that are taking place, and many of them are conversations. Our goal today is to help put the U.S. civil rights movement that is much more familiar to Americans in an international context by exploring the provocative parallels between this movement and the liberation struggle in South Africa. You may ask, why South Africa? Why would we make this choice? There are many reasons. MSU has a long and deep relationship with South Africa. I'm not going to go into that. Many of you know that well. But what is notable is that South Africa is also celebrating 20 years of democracy this year and the liberation struggle that has produced what is often referred to as the new South Africa. And having just returned there about 2 weeks from South Africa, where I was for 3 weeks, you couldn't go anywhere without having people writing about and talking about the 20-year anniversary. And the passing of Mr. Mandela has made this even a more urgent topic. So for today, we're doing something we're calling 60-50-20, if you will, and you'll engage with us in conversation. As part of this 20th commemoration, the country continues to reflect on how it has transformed politically, educationally, socially, and environmentally, and most controversially, economically in South Africa. I'd like to make a few comments about South Africa, just to give you a sense of the topics that I heard about while I was there, and then we're going to turn to our panel. The conversation in South Africa is lively, to be sure. In certain arenas, real advancement can be acknowledged, and I suppose celebrated. In other areas, there is an ongoing dialogue about not being able to meet rising expectations, inability to match delivery with investments, and the promise of a democratic, non-racial, non-sexist South Africa not yet realized. However, though, in the past 20 years, take a moment, I could imagine Mr. Kathrada sitting here and he would be saying to me, but tell him some of the things we have done. The proportion of households with electricity dropped from 49% in 1995 to 26% in the most recent study in 2012. In that same period, 2 million households acquired state-subsidized housing. The black middle class has grown to 4.2 million in 2013 from 1.7 million in 2004. This is a UCT study. Yet, as continually is being discussed in South Africa, you sometimes feel the echoes here in this country, economic inequality persists. It is worsening even on many measures. There are still significant inequalities in education. In public schools, university matric pass rates have increased from a mere 18% in 1994 to 27% in 2012. While independent schools have increased their rates from 70 to 84% in the same period. So if you want to think of it this way, a student in a public school has 1 in 4 chances of going to a university, where a student in an independent school would have 4 in 5 chances to enter a university in South Africa today. I share this data as there's much data analysis like this going on in South Africa, as I say, this year. However, there's also going on many other conversations that we're trying to foster, like here, civil conversations, conversations where we take time to listen as much as to speak. And that's one of the keys for us today. Our conversation today will be initiated by a distinguished group of MSU faculty who bring a special perspective to the understanding of this topic. They are really conversation starters for us today. I've asked each of them to begin the conversation with a brief introductory statement of, yes, I really did tell them this, 5 to 7 minutes each, focusing on reflecting on progress made, obstacles that have not been overcome, and steps that can be taken to move forward, and where appropriate, they can to be shared in both places. So they will be sharing in where they can, parallels and connections between the two struggles, where that can be done, differences and then between the two struggles, as well as those next steps forward. So I'd like to open this up now for conversation. I urge you all to be thinking about how you can get involved in this as a conversation. The participating panelists for this conversation are Dr. Peter Rileggi, professor of history, a South African specialist. Peter, just give a little wave. Everybody knows Peter here, I think. Joe Darden, professor of geography and faculty in the African and African American Studies program. Christy Bowman, who is with the College of Law and a specialist in educational law. And also, Peter Lim, who is the adjunct associate professor in history and the Afrikaner bibliographer at the MSU Library and a very prolific scholar on South Africa. I also want to just thank the MSU Library that's recording this session for us today, so I hope we all can benefit from this in years to come and look back on this conversation today. So I'd like to start off by asking Peter Rileggi to start. Peter?
Thanks, Kurt. It's a bit funny to be given a brief as a scholar to speak for only 5 to 7 minutes, since that's about as long as it takes us to ask a question, usually. But I'll try nevertheless. The African...
It's just your first start. You can enter back into the conversation.
That's 1 minute,
no? The African-American political scientist Chris Halisi, in his book, Black Political Thought in the Making of South African Democracy, explores how men and women's resistance to colonialism, to segregation, to apartheid, quote, fluctuated incessantly between the values of racial autonomy and interracial social incorporation, end quote. In the context of the anti-apartheid struggle, especially in the 1970s, this tension between racial integrationism, if you will, and race-conscious nationalism came to be embodied in the difference between Steve Biko and Nelson Mandela. In the context of the US civil rights movement, this same tension was represented, or even sometimes reduced, to the figures of Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X. In South Africa, the ideology, strategy, and tactics of the many different movements that challenged racial oppression actually represented a broad political spectrum, from moderate to liberal to radical. And if you look at individual organizations over time, such as the Liberation Movement turned ruling party African National Congress, they themselves changed from race-based constitutional protests in the earlier period to racially inclusive mass defiance campaigns, strikes, and reluctantly, armed struggle. I don't have time, obviously, to get into the genealogy of non-racialism in South Africa, but I do want to point out that black and white communists such as Ahmed Kathrada made important, even decisive contributions to entrenching non-racialism in anti-apartheid politics and also in the new South African constitution. This principle was enshrined in the Freedom Charter, the blueprint of the liberation struggle adopted in 1955 by the Congress of the People, which states in its preamble, South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. Now, one of Ahmed Kathrada's closest friends was Bram Fischer, a communist attorney who came from a distinguished conservative white Afrikaner family. In fact, his grandfather had been prime minister of what became the Orange Free State. Bram led the defense team at the Rivonia trial in 1963-64 and helped Mandela, Katrada, Dennis Goldberg, another white communist who will visit MSU in late April, and five others avoid a seemingly inevitable death sentence and getting life sentences instead. So what motivated Fischer's lifelong resistance to racism and injustice, both in the courtroom and underground? In his biographer Stephen Klingman's words, quote, his choice emphasized the nature of the struggle and even helped to define it. That it was by all and for all for a whole society rather than a racially demarcated one. His work was a protest, a refusal to participate in iniquity, but it was also a positive search, a radical statement of the possibility and necessity of a new and undivided world. Fischer himself was arrested about a year and a half later, after Mandela was sent to prison with Katrada and the others, and released only about a decade later on humanitarian grounds to die of cancer at his brother's home. In a moving letter from Robben Island Prison dated May 11, 1975, Katrada wrote to Fischer's daughters and said the following, quote, South Africa could ill afford to lose him, for he was a great patriot and statesman, rich in wisdom, selfless, fearless, and determined in leadership. To the legal fraternity, he brought brilliance, luster, and distinction. To his political colleagues, he showed the path of courage, clarity, and undying hope. To the prisoner, he reenacted the well-established maxim that the road to light and progress traverses through the darkness of prison walls. To humanity at large, he gave of his abundant love, his charm, his unequaled modesty, quiet dignity, and disinterestedness. Bram possesses in profusion all the elements that make for a perfect human being, end quote. For Mandela himself, Fischer, as he wrote in Long Walk to Freedom, quote, had made the greatest sacrifice of all. Bram was a free man who fought against his own people to ensure the freedom of others, end quote. So today we celebrate 20 years of democracy in South Africa and its many achievements. Kurt already listed several. Maybe I'll overlap a few, but worth mentioning. A new and extremely progressive, some would say the most progressive constitution in the world, with a strong Bill of Rights. Democratic elections that have been unfolding since 1994 at local, provincial, and national level. Checks and balances between the executive, the legislative, and judicial branches. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission process that, while partial, was certainly important and lauded internationally. A free and independent media. Promotion of women's rights and affirmative action in politics and business, increased access to basic services for poor South Africans, and of course, I couldn't not include South Africa's successful hosting of the 2010 World Cup, which Katrada himself incidentally closes his memoirs with, saying that the hosting of the World Cup was a beacon for South Africa's future. Of course, many challenges remain. On the eve of national elections next month, or actually in May, non-racialism still reemerges in the public space on occasion. And we saw this with the explosion of kind of rainbow nationalism in the wake of Nelson Mandela's death. But at this moment, race-conscious populism is ascendant in political discourse once again, as demonstrated by the recent rise of Julius Malema's economic freedom fighters. This is an opportunistic, but politically very savvy, new party that has split from the ANC and garners support by tapping into black South Africans' dissatisfaction with gaping inequality, high unemployment, violent crime, including police killings of striking miners at Marikana, and widespread corruption. And this development, I think, is a reminder of why the Katrada Foundation's ongoing work to document the past through the lens of non-racialism is so important. It's one of the most powerful legacies of the global anti-apartheid movement and should never be forgotten. Thank you.
Joe, can I call on you? You may call on me anytime you wish. Thank you very much. I want to thank you, by the way, for hosting this. I think it's important that we convey information whenever we have the opportunity around these critical issues facing society today. And this struggle in the U.S. and South Africa should be compared, but should also be compared with caution. And I say that only because when it comes to parallels in the United States, this struggle essentially started after the Plessy versus Ferguson decision back in 1896. So in a sense, back in the 1800s, we've had this struggle in the U.S. It is just that most of it has occurred in trying to address legal segregation, which essentially came about based on the ideology of white supremacy, whereby the white supremacists translated the ideology into state law, which created a situation of segregation by law, meaning that in this case, white supremacy had to be maintained through any means necessary. When those laws were not respected, violence was used, terrorism was used, and first domestic terrorists were essentially the Klan and others who used the terrorism to intimidate blacks as well as whites into obeying these laws that were created out of the ideology of white supremacy. So in the United States, we've had two opposing ideologies. One was the ideology of the democracy, which came about after the Constitution. Then the ideology of white supremacy. Those ideologies have been constantly opposing each other over time. So throughout history, there's been an attack on each of them, and there's been some progress in dealing with the legal aspect of it, but the white supremacy is deeply ingrained in the culture of both countries, and so it makes it much more difficult to address in practice, even though you may be able to address some of it in terms of legal. After the Plessy versus Ferguson, you had the 1917 Buchanan versus Wally, which attacked, in a sense, state by state, block by block, segregation by law, in which blacks had to live on certain blocks that whites couldn't live on, and whites were required to live on certain blocks that blacks couldn't live on. That was addressed in the case of Buchanan versus Wally in 1917. And after that, there were other efforts to maintain white supremacy, and through restrictive covenants based on race, and that was essentially challenged. Again, this is a civil rights struggle. They were challenging the decision of race restrictive covenants, and that was essentially successful in 1948, Shelley versus Kramer, which got rid of the race restrictive covenants. And then the white supremacists and not those who believe in that turned to rely on real estate brokers, apartment managers, banks, and others to guarantee that neighborhoods would stay white, predominantly white, and those who were non-whites could not enter those neighborhoods. So the real estate brokers and that industry essentially took on the responsibility of keeping neighborhood segregated by race. And they continued to do that without much recourse until 1968 Fair Housing Act, which was again a struggle. It wasn't easy to get that act passed. It was due to struggle by those who wanted more legislation to protect those who were discriminated against. Those activities occurred, if you don't know East Lansing, in this particular city, there was a struggle to bring about the Fair Housing Act because professors could not live in East Lansing. Even though they could teach here, they couldn't live here. And so that's a struggle I always tell my students. East Lansing today is not like East Lansing used to be. So don't ever forget that history. So the struggle continues. So now we have a situation whereby the most difficult thing to address, and this is no doubt probably true in South Africa as well, and that is residential patterns that are socioeconomically unequal by race and class. Because by having neighborhoods that are socioeconomically unequal, you have segregated schools, which are not as good. You have the jobs that are more plentiful in those white neighborhoods and not in those others. The neighborhoods themselves are more deprived if they're black or non-white. And so now the key basis for perpetuating what I call white supremacy is essentially through keeping those neighborhoods separate and unequal, which is what the Plessy versus Ferguson decision was done legally. Now it is done in practice by way of racial steering by real estate brokers and apartment managers, and it is by whites avoiding neighborhoods that are non-white, and then by whites continuing to move to the outer suburbs using spatial distance as a basis to perpetuate inequality. That becomes the basis for the future in terms of segregation. Now, in those two struggles, I always like to point out, though, to not overgeneralize, there have always been some whites who I call free whites. These are whites who are not held to the burden of the ideology of white supremacy, but instead they're willing to sacrifice, join the struggle, and then put their lives on the line as well. Those whites have always been, historically speaking, in small numbers, small percentage. How different it would be if that number were much larger, but it has not been. But I'd always like to point out those in the struggle that that have done that. And it was pointed out a few minutes ago, Goldberg in South Africa. In the U.S., you had Michael Schwinnum in Mississippi, who Goodman gave their lives for the struggle. That kind of behavior has always been around, and I always like to point it out, for those whites who've done that, they deserve a special place in the history of the civil rights movement. So I'd like to give them credit for that, because only a few have done it over time. Where do we go from here in the future? As far as I'm concerned, unless we can address this whole issue of neighborhood residential segregation by class and race, we'll never be able to deal with the situation to provide equal educational opportunity, regardless of Brown versus Board of Education. One limitation of Brown is that Brown only addressed legal segregation. It did not address segregation in practice, which is deeply ingrained in the culture. That piece has not been addressed yet, and until it is addressed in the future, we're always going to have this inequality by race, inequality by class, inequality by place. The last frontier is to deal with the residential segregation by race and class. That's fine.
Thank you. How much time do you have?
Well, I'll also try and bounce off some of the excellent themes of the previous two speakers, and I'll also include some East Lansing connections and speak also on this continued inequality, which is a big issue in both countries. And Peter has elaborated non-racialism in South Africa, and I'll take a slightly different tack, but just to point out that non-racialism as a theory, if you like, or a practice, was developed as an antidote to the poison of highly institutionalized racist apartheid. So that was in many ways why that term was used. And the wonderful exhibitions downstairs on Ahmed Kathy Kathrada and African American struggles make this clear. There are many interesting parallels, but some contrast between the national liberation struggle in South Africa and the US civil rights movement. And I recently put up a small related exhibit in the MSU library on the first floor near the new book display. So have a look at that. It has examples from our rich collections, including Martin Luther King's growing interest in South Africa before he died, Black Panther solidarity with South Africans, Kathrada's works, and the library has an authorized copy of his correspondence, a selection of which a retired MSU faculty member, Bob Vassin, published with the MSU Press. I mentioned the, there it is there, the African Activist Archive, which was started by Professor David Wiley at the back here with a veteran anti-apartheid and African solidarity activist in New York, Richard Knight. And they and Chris Root here and I have been building that archive. And from that archive, remember we are a university, so we can help dig out this history. We can dig out the comparative history, and we can dig out from these burgeoning collections these stories for future generations. So, for instance, from the papers of George Hauser of the American Committee on Africa to those of Mary Louise Hooper, the Californian Quaker, and secretary of the Nobel Prize-winning ANC leader Albert Luthuli, to the archives of the East Lansing Southern Africa Liberation Committee, these and other collections await your researchers, and I can see some grad students in the room, and I can endorse these very interesting and unique collections for your work. I might mention others, such as the T-shirt collection of Prexy Nesbitt, the African-American anti-apartheid activist in Chicago, the papers of John and Eleanor Ruling, the first married couple who went straight from East Lansing in 1927 to Adams College south of Durban, where they learnt his Zulu language and soon befriended Chief Luthuli. So there are some intriguing connections between East Lansing and South Africa. We have a very large collection, movies, newspapers, posters, and so on. So both of these struggles have great depth, over three centuries, in fact, and we glimpse them but fleetingly in recent films such as 12 Years a Slave or Mandela. So again, I just underline that we as university people can help to sculpt these stories, histories of slavery and civil rights, the geography, if you like, of current inequalities in both countries. Interestingly, my recent book on the ANC's first newspaper includes a chapter on Garveyism in South Africa by Robert Vinson, who was recently here. And the two Roberts, Vinson and Edgar, will shortly publish their opus magnum on African-American connections with South Africa, going back to the 1790s. And my new book with Dr. Chicha Kwala in Bloemfontein is entitled The Freedom Struggle in the Free State, and it includes quite a lot of material on the prominent role of black South African leaders of the AME Church in that part of South Africa. But we can make too much of these connections, and there was a warning earlier about being careful with the comparisons. We must be careful not to view African history through American spectacles. And here I want to underline the Africanness of the liberation struggle. It was very much a non-racial struggle. It was indeed a non-racial movement, but it was also predominantly expressed in African idioms and fought predominantly with African fists. And let me just end then with a reference to Cathy Cathrada, truly a South African activist for non-racialism, and his longtime friend, the late and sadly missed Nelson Mandela. Both were very well aware of the strong support behind apartheid, racist and colonial domination from the West, especially establishment Britain and the US. But they were also well aware of courageous struggles waged over the years by fighters such as Paul Robeson, Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, and they deeply appreciated the solidarity from these and other ordinary people in the United States. And remember that solidarity is always mutual. It's not just a one-way street. And when I talk to South African activists, they sometimes talk of the need to return this solidarity, whether for striking US workers, for Occupy or environmental activists, or simply to engage in partnerships, such as with museums and universities, those working to bring out this rich heritage of the civil rights and anti-apartheid struggles and their connections. And I couldn't agree more with the with Peter that about continuing inequalities. It has been and remains a long, hard journey. South Africa today is full of contradictions of a new yet at the same time old kind. And Kurt gave us some statistics of some slow but steady progress, and that's undeniable. But also undeniable is a rampant capitalism, the shooting of mine workers that Peter mentioned at Marikana. Very severe housing, health and service delivery crises. So at the last African Studies Association meeting, I went to a panel by Brij Maharaj, a geographer outside of Durban, and his talk was all about the continued forced removals that are going on south of Durban to try and build a new superport with Chinese capital and ordinary people being driven out of their homes. And so I'm afraid we're stuck with these contradictions of globalization. And ironically, I have to speak next month to a symposium on the life of Nelson Mandela in Indiana, but the very thing that endured Nelson Mandela to global powers, reconciliation, ironically made it harder to achieve a more meaningful socioeconomic liberation. This is the intense irony and contradiction that we're grappling with. So the entrenchment of white economic privilege in the country and continuing sharp class inequality has in many ways facilitated this growth of a black middle class that Kurt mentioned, but it's not done much at all for either the urban black working class or rural peoples who still constitute the overwhelming majority of the population. And so it was a long walk to political freedom, but it'll be a longer one still to full social and economic freedom in both countries. But I think the connections and the solidarities engendered through these times over three centuries can help. And I think that we can continue to make meaningful partnerships with South Africans that can bring about greater understanding between the two peoples and hopefully move this forward. Let me just end on two anecdotes. Peter mentioned both Bram Fischer and the Cathrada Foundation. I was recently in Bloemfontein, the capital of the Free State in South Africa, and when you get off the plane, you're struck by the Bram Fischer Airport. So there's a wonderful symbolism there. And in Johannesburg, the foundation, the Cathrada Foundation, is now working with a very old friend of mine from Soweto, Ashanti Mhlapo, who's a black psychiatrist, who is trying, with the assistance of the foundation, to do something to give back to the society that gave birth to her by building a black psychiatric clinic in historically disadvantaged areas that are almost completely bereft of those sorts of facilities. So let me just end there.
Thank you, Peter.
Okay.
Christy Bowman.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here this afternoon with such wonderful fellow panelists talking about these important issues. So I thought I would start thinking a little bit more about education equity and equality in the U.S. today and reflecting on how we've gotten to the point where we are. And specifically, I wanted to start by talking about the Supreme Court's 2007 decision in Parents Involved, the Parents Involved case. So we had two situations, one from Kentucky and one from Seattle, in which both of our school districts wanted to create more integrated schools than neighborhood school boundaries were going to give them. So they created programs to try and help this happen. And of course, those were challenged, and both cases made their way to the Supreme Court, where the parties ended up fighting essentially about what the true meaning of Brown versus Board of Education was. And it was fascinating to see these polar opposite interpretations of Brown. One saying very much, Brown is about anti-subordination. Brown is about fighting white supremacy and protecting the group that has been discriminated against and disadvantaged for so long. Now, if we take that approach, then certainly this idea of greater integration makes sense, especially because we're focusing more on equity. We're focusing on the idea that we don't have to treat everyone exactly the same, that we can have good reasons for treating people differently. So that was one approach. Of course, that was the approach that lost in the Supreme Court. And the approach that won was the anti-classification approach, looking back at Brown and saying the central harm that the Supreme Court identified in 1954, the central harm was that we were looking at children and classifying them on the basis of race, that we were looking at children as though they are racial chits, right? They are racial pawns to be moved about. That's the harm. And if that's the central harm, then the solution is, well, we don't classify based on race, even if what we're trying to do is create more integrated schools and a more integrated society. So, of course, that's what led to Chief Justice Roberts' famous statement that the way to stop discrimination is to stop discriminating. The idea that we cannot think about race, we cannot be color conscious and be moving forward in our society. Now, I think the reason I wanted to focus on these two competing approaches is, well, actually for a couple of reasons. One is because when I think about the potential for law to create social change, it means thinking about what arguments are going to be successful ultimately, and then, even if we lose, what are the other options? In other words, how close can we get to the line in terms of still pursuing the goals that we have? So in 2007, after this decision was announced, the NAACP came out with a very interesting publication pretty soon thereafter, which said, okay, you want integrated schools. The Supreme Court tells you you cannot consider the race of individual children when you're figuring that out. But here are a whole host of other ways in which we can still pursue those goals. Here are practical, on-the-ground policies. And so being aware of the potential for law to create social change is important. but also not relying completely on law to do that. Recognizing that, you know, as with the parents involved decision, in the United States, our race jurisprudence has gotten increasingly conservative, increasingly focused on color blindness. And yet, well, and that is incredibly discouraging. And yet, that is also not the end of the story. And so a few questions I wanted to raise in conclusion is that it struck me that, at least on paper, South Africa is much more committed to the idea of equity. And I oppose equity to equality. Again, equality being this idea of treating individuals very much all the same, and equity making allowances for differences. And so in terms of, you know, thinking about South Africa being referred to as having one of the most progressive constitutions, that's where I see that language, that's where I see that potential. And yet, I wonder very much about how that has translated, how that has worked out. Because when we think about what does that look like in practice, that's, of course, where the rubber meets the road. That's where it gets quite complicated. So that's one big difference in the two, and I'd be very curious and very grateful to hear others' perspectives and responses to that question. Additionally, something that I find very interesting as a scholar of education law is that South Africa has some of the most specific national education statutes that exist. Now, in the US, most of our education regulation happens at the state level. We have federal negative rights, so federal anti-discrimination rights, most of which are equality-based rights, though some, like our disability discrimination, are equity-based. So we have these negative anti-discrimination rights at the national level. Our positive rights, our right to education, our rights in education are very much at the state level. So South Africa, again, very progressive constitution, and the state, or the national statutes regulating education, just this incredible level of specificity, which I assume responds to the desire to have consistency across the country, and also really is an appeal to the rule of law. The idea that it is meaningful and significant to have these things be enshrined in law. The idea of creating rights that exist at that national level, that that is an important thing, that there are enforcement mechanisms that can make that happen. So again, I'm delighted to be here with you all today, and I look forward to the forthcoming conversation.
Thank you, Christy. What we'd like to do, again, this is a conversation, and these are great starters. I'm sure each of them would like to respond to each other and question each other too, which I hope they will do. But we want to move out of the format of a regular academic presentation, you know, presenters where you just ask questions. You may have your own views you want to share about this topic or what we're exploring, these parallels, your own experience being in South Africa or experiences here. So we want to share the floor though, to get make everyone feel comfortable to share. So if someone would like to share a reaction, a response, something that they've been thinking about around this topic. John Beck. Okay. And John, let me do what you know I need to do here. So I'm going to, since we're recording this, what I'm going to do is we're going to put this one here so that our
I guess having worked in both countries, when Ann and I went on our sabbatical in 1998, it was only a few years after the change in government. So it was a very heady time in a variety of ways. Just let me start off with a quote from the education field. One scholar named Namenworth always says something that I loved, which is just because we are not conscious that we have bias does not make us unbiased, it makes us unconscious. But the interesting thing, and Christy, this is really, I'm fascinated by some legal parallels between the two nations. So as already has been said, the Constitution in South Africa is an unbelievable document. In my case, the fact that they make a labor union membership a constitutional right rather than a state-by-state right or a federally legislated right is interesting. But I think that picking up on Joe's point, what you seem to have in the two countries that I think is very different is that here in the United States, we had a state-by-state administration of a national white supremacy rather than a national administration of a white supremacy. And I think that that leads to some real interesting things, because I think throughout the civil rights period, we were still white supremacists perhaps in the North, but we regarded the civil rights to be something that had to be fought for and won in the South rather than the North. So I think that there's kind of been a variegated experience. It's interesting in South Africa that what you have is white supremacy in a white minority versus here in the United States we have white supremacy in a white majority. I think that that is a huge sea change between the two. We always found it interesting that naturally then when the democratic instinct comes out, automatically you turn the tables because now suddenly a majority that has been enslaved by a minority can become a majority in fact and in government. And last but not least, I think that all of you have raised this in a different way, that class is not a protected category under U.S. law or under South African law. That is, that capital and property still trump in both nations dramatically. So as long as, you know, class, race was a major stand-in for class in the United States in a way for a long time. I think that race and class were very much coterminous in South Africa. So now that if class is not a protected category, much of what you've talked about is the continuing inequality in both nations. And so any and all of you to respond to any of those points would be fun.
Anyone like to respond?
Let me respond to it. I'm always addressing this issue of is it race or is it class, because there are those today who want to believe that there has been the decline of significance of race. My fellow Professor Wilson, for example, at the University of Chicago, when I was a graduate student, used to always talk about the decline of significance of race. He changed his views later on that. But the point is that we can separate those two things out, race and class. In my own research, I've been able to clearly demonstrate that race operates independently of class when it comes to issues like discrimination in housing, for example. Blacks who are PhDs and MDs are discriminated against when a white person who is unemployed is not. So in a sense, you have to separate those out and not let the argument go that race and class are somewhat so intertwined that you can't uncouple those. I think we have to do that. And so my concern would be essentially dealing with this continuous issue of discrimination on the basis of race, and I think that the class piece will somewhat be less important. I say that for this reason. When it comes to issues of schools, for example, which I've been looking at very, very carefully these days, our school system, public schools, essentially use attendance zones and school district boundaries to exclude people, and they continue to do that. Now, once you do that, and then you have a tax system that essentially allows property taxes to be the basis to fund the schools, you are inherently creating inequality in perpetuity. It's going to happen because you know that the situation is unequal. It's known. Everybody knows that. And that inequality gives an advantage to those who are white and middle and upper class. We all know that. Now, the solution then is not to build these schools again or whatever you want to do in these low socioeconomic neighborhoods that are predominantly black and Latino. That's not the answer, never will be. No matter whether you call them charter schools or ESA, what do you want to call them? That's a failure, it's not gonna change anything. I've advocated that we must have accessibility for those who wish to live in school districts that are high achieving regardless of where they are. So in that sense, if a person wants to have their kid in a high-achieving school, given our present distribution of where high-achieving schools are, they are disproportionately in predominantly white neighborhoods. So these Latinos and blacks will never get an equal education as long as they're being educated in schools that are racially separate and unequal. That's my solution to the problem. You have to deal with that. And so the pressure should be not to build us more charter schools in our black neighborhood, or not to build us other kind of schools. You have to give access to those high achieving schools, wherever they may be. That's been my criticism of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, because they stress, for example, race as opposed to dealing with inequality in terms of school achievement. If you deal with that, forget race. Where are the high achieving schools? If every child has access to a high achieving school, it doesn't matter what the race is being. Because the issue is inequality in academic achievement based on the education they receive. It just so happened that it's disproportionately now based on class and race. That's the issue. So Brown decision should have addressed that one. Had they done that, we wouldn't have mattered. Linda Brown, for example, lived in an integrated neighborhood. The best school she could have attended was right down the streets. They forced Linda Brown to be bused somewhere else in a school that was low achieving. That was wrong, and that's what they did. So in a sense, you have to focus on what the real issue is.
Yeah, and to continue with that line of thought and also think back to the issue of class, part of what's interesting is because of the way that the law has developed, making it so difficult for school districts, even districts or states who want to create racially integrated schools, it's so difficult for them to do that at this point in time, it's much easier for school district to say, well, let's just create an integrated system based on class or based on socioeconomic status, because legally, the level of scrutiny that a school district is going to have is much lower. So to have that sort of system is A, politically much more palatable, and B, legally easier. So as a result, it's in terms of school integration, it's one of the fastest growing education policies in the United States. Very, very rapid. And yet, of course, as you mentioned, that is all, a lot of that is very interestingly based on this mistaken assumption that we can exchange these two variables. Yeah. And so that just doesn't even work. And it's very strange to me that in some situations, it's proponents of integration who are relying on this mistaken assumption and therefore focusing much more on class.
Two huge areas. One, these changes in South Africa that have brought about monumental historic transformation from white supremacy to a more democratic dispensation. But on the other hand, the continuing inequalities of class and in the entrenched sense even of race, or in some ways gender and other aspects. So John started with this wonderful quote about loss of consciousness, was it, or forgetting?
It's not that we're unbiased, we're simply unconscious.
So on the news this morning that Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, was just not aware that his supporters had spent millions of rand on embellishing and improving and beautifying his property in Nkandla, in Zululand. And he was also not conscious about the affairs that led to the infamous rape trial, of which he was acquitted. So, I mean, there's this intriguing intersection between class and race, of corruption and opening up of opportunities, and we have to think through them carefully, and we have to think through their connections. But I would argue that one of the most festering causes of growing discontent in South Africa today is the dropping of the ball of class in South Africa. So although we have people like Cyril Ramaphosa, who I met in the 80s when he was the head of the Mine Workers Union, is now probably the richest black person in South Africa and may perhaps be the next president. We see this rise of a small yet quite wealthy black upper class, and yet we see the, as I mentioned earlier, these continuing inequalities when it comes to ordinary people, which underlie the tragedy of the Marikana massacre. And it sort of, to some ways, is also reflected in questions of law, because whilst we do have the most in my opinion, in most people's position, opinion, I think, the most democratic, the most inclusive, progressive constitution in the world in South Africa. At the local level, we have glaring contradictions with things like customary law, the continuing power of indigenous rulers, and how they are now challenging the constitutional rights of women and land rights at the local level. And so this is very complex, and African tradition is very rich and has brought much inclusiveness through the institution of the council meeting, the khotla, or Ubuntu in other ways. So Africa has made a wonderful contribution, and the South African contribution to these sorts of new ways of thinking based upon old indigenous traditions of inclusiveness, whereby Mandela would always epitomize the wise African ruler who would just be quiet and listen to everyone and then make a ruling, rather like a Supreme Court judge. And so there are all these different balls in play, but I think the dropping of the ball of class was really what underpinned what I said earlier, this historic compromise that broke the logjam. Yes, it broke the logjam which we thought would never break, much as we perhaps today still look at Palestinian-Israeli issues as a logjam. Will it ever break? It broke that logjam. But it dropped the ball of class. It dropped the ball of land reform. And so when you go to the Free State, which is the most unequal of all provinces of South Africa, you realize that the overwhelming percentage of that land, of that province, has no very few black farmers, very few black properties. And so that was the classic example of the complete, if you like, expropriation of black people from the land. How do you then undo that? That 300 years of inequality, how do you undo it without having some kind of either legal or industrial or electoral pressure to do the second logjam breaking, if you like, which is entrenched power? And often that translates to great discontent from the unemployed, from migrants from other countries, and the accompanying xenophobic violence or other forms of inequality.
Can I add one short thing? One is about the South African elite's awareness of the role of class in the post-apartheid period reflected in the constitution itself. I mean, there are socioeconomic rights embedded in the constitution. One of the distinguishing qualities, I think, improves it quite a bit in theory from the American one. You can see this in the access to healthcare, food, water, social security, housing, etc. Those are all part of the Bill of Rights. So it's not just political enfranchisement, but the state has to demonstrate a reasonable movement towards the achievement of those socioeconomic rights. And obviously the trade union rights that you spoke to are part of that as well. The second thing about class and race and how they're working out in post-apartheid South Africa that's interesting to me is the amount of racial mixing and actual integration that's taking place in sort of suburban gated enclaves among the upper middle class, which is increasingly racially mixed itself. And so, you know, the language of non-racialism, you start to see this even in political discourse, has been appropriated by historically actually quite conservative sort of center-right forces like the Democratic Alliance, for instance, but also in the sports realm by historically white sports like rugby. You know, they become the great defenders of meritocratic achievement now, which conveniently takes advantage of those historical privileges that they've built their success on. So unjustly, many would argue. So I just wanted to add those 2 points.
All right, I'd be interested if the panel had any comments on what strikes me as a very important context for the struggles in the two countries, which is namely the global context, specifically in the last 50 years, the Cold War. As well, I mean, Peter's alluded to the solidarity movements in the U.S. and other countries with the struggle in South Africa. There seems to be less of that in the case of the U.S. movements, although one does remember Martin Luther King hearing Kwame Nkrumah saying, free at last, free at last, to achieve that goal. But I'm just wondering if what that global context of communism, capitalism, contesting world, the colonial globalization of Africa, not in the U.S. so much, and the global struggle in even down to the Cuban forces in Angola fighting the Cuerno Valle against the South African Defense Forces, and which many date as the turning point of that struggle there. So I'd be interested in your reflections on how that context affected the two movements.
Well, I think the global context is key in many ways. I mean, it's not to ignore the national or the local importance in history or in politics today, but obviously when the ANC won the first democratic election in 1994, it was in a completely changed international environment. And in Southern Africa, the Cold War was a very hot war. It was a war involving wars, conflict, killing, massacres in a number of countries, Angola, Lesotho, Mozambique. The lady that I mentioned early, Ashanti Mshlapo, I first met her in Harare, and she was a refugee, an ANC supporter, a refugee who'd crossed over, and I've lived with and met many exiles, and I'm currently refereeing a very complex book for a South African university press that is dealing, one of the chapters deals with Namibia, another with Angola, another with Swaziland, and another deals with the US, or what it's called the Western superpowers and Francophone Africa, and looks at Côte d'Ivoire and Gabon, and particularly Côte d'Ivoire, where in many ways the conservative government there was used as a sort of proxy of the West, and the author has used extensive Department of State files of correspondence of US diplomats in the Cold War to show just how much interaction and succor there was around this alternative strategy of dialogue with Pretoria at the height of chronic apartheid, of bestial and vicious apartheid. The US State Department under different administrations were strongly encouraging Houphouet Boigny in Côte d'Ivoire to broker a sort of a breakthrough, break the logjam of African solidarity through the Organization of African Unity based in Addis Ababa, which was fairly solid but which was starting to break up through the Cold War manipulation. So a similar thing happened in Senegal with Leopold Senghor, and people like Nkrumah that David mentioned were some of those who stood out. And so as I've been reading on this topic, it struck me how the overwhelming majority of African countries did not fall for this gambit by Cote d'Ivoire and Washington, but they stuck true to their principles of solidarity with the struggling peoples of South Africa. And so, I mean, that's historically sort of a comment on just how significant it was. The South African government, the supremacist Rhodesian government, the Portuguese in Mozambique and Angola, they were all really part of a Cold War united front with Britain and the United States establishments. And that's why it was so hard in the anti-apartheid movement for people like Martin Luther King, for Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson was sort of sent to Coventry. So hard also for those white activists. And I was reminded of a white US activist in Mississippi who was whipped and beaten and tortured for joining civil rights struggles in the 60s, and went on as an elderly man, relocated to South Africa, and has written this magisterial study of black concentration camps in the Boer War, which is because the Boer War is always seen as a white man's war. And I just was corresponding with a professor in Harvard who's not an Africanist, but she had asked me to read her notes on this fascinating early visit of some of pioneer feminists from Holland and the US, Mrs. Catt from the US and a Dutch feminist. And she had a note about the Boer War or the South African War, and all the Afrikaners who perished in. And I said, well, excuse me, there is this wonderful white American who put his life and limb on the line and was tortured in Mississippi, who's now done all this research and was awarded a PhD in Cape Town for this, to show that actually more black people died in concentration camps than white people, than Afrikaners. So, I mean, that's sort of to veer away from the Cold War, but I think part of this is a question of power. So the Cold War was really about global power. Things have changed now, but the globalization in an economic sense is still about power. And so many South African and US industries have been downscaled in the Midwest, in Ohio, Michigan, the Rust Belt. The same thing is now happening in South Africa. Textiles out, send it all to Indonesia or China. Many other industries in South Africa have closed down. And so there again was the conundrum of Mandela coming to power, the first black president. But I'm sorry, folks, you know, we've got to take your industries away now, so unemployment's going to go up. So we come back to the conundrum of class and race in this global sense.
I guess three things come to mind about contemporary dynamics and globalization. One is that there are global networks that have developed of solidarity around specific issues. And if you look at HIV/AIDS in South Africa, for instance, you know, the Treatment Action Campaign is one of many groups, and they operate now as part of a global web of these organizations, both within the African continent, but also internationally. And it's a way in which I think grassroots, if you want to call them that, organizations have been able to marshal the forces of globalization to good effect to get some positive changes after many, many years on, in this case, HIV/AIDS policy by the government in South Africa. There are many others that you know, anti-privatization campaigns, environmental justice campaigns, and so on, linking with, you know, groups in the Niger Delta, for instance, or elsewhere. So that's one. The second one is the involvement of China in Africa, which is clearly the biggest transformation from a political and economic perspective since probably the imposition of the WTO rules. And the arrival of China has changed the economic landscape, but it's also offered some new geopolitical possibilities for African nations. And the third thing is the global war on terror, so-called war on terror, the war on a noun. And the involvement of South Africa is actually quite interesting in this respect, where they fall in terms of their working cooperation with the United States, but also kind of skeptical of U.S. and Western sort of neo-imperial power. So those are just some things that come to mind.
Let me just say one thing here. When I opened up, I talked about this word of caution. I recall a radio interview not too long ago where Desmond Tutu was talking, and the reporter asked, well, look, I mean, why are things so difficult in South Africa of dealing with this issue of this class inequality? He said, look, I mean, been 20 years, we just had this. How many years have you had? You've had it, and you still haven't addressed it, so, you know. So keep that in mind when we start looking at the parallels between the two countries. I mean, it has been a lot of time in South Africa, and we shouldn't put ourselves up as a kind of a model of what can be when we're still struggling all these years, and we still have not mastered this thing they call democracy and equality of everybody and so forth. So it's still an issue out there. It takes a long time to deal with it.
Exactly.
We don't want it to be a monologue, so please, if you haven't got a question, make a comment. I mean, Tutu, wonderful guy, and I first met him in the 80s and introduced him to a white, elderly Jewish South African who laughed and said, oh, I picked you up in Lesotho when you were hitchhiking in your on the dusty streets in your cassock. And of course, there's a sort of an irony there of Tutu himself then living now in was living in a huge wealthy mansion in Bishopsgate in Cape Town as Archbishop and so on. So I think that brings us back to the personal, to the individual. Who are we to talk about race, and who are we to talk about class? Who am I to talk about race? Who am I to talk about class? And so in that sense, looking at it from almost a spiritual perspective or a philosophical perspective, a lot of these things still come back to the individual. Peter mentioned the networks. A lot of those networks are very mobile, very vigorous, but they're not particularly powerful. So how do we manage to go from protest to transformation? How do we, and this comes back to your earlier point, how do we actually get things done with the law? These are really important issues. And maybe some of you have been involved in
the Treatment Action Campaign is actually working with the AIDS Law Project at WITS is a good example of far from powerless. I mean, they were the ones who brought the lawsuits to bear and forced the South African government to provide access to treatment for people in public hospitals. So, I mean, I disagree that they don't have power. I think the problem is that on some issues it works well, on many others it doesn't. I mean, the TAC used the Constitution, the new constitution in South Africa, to show the government that they weren't doing what they themselves had just ratified a few years earlier, right?
That's important.
And that's one tangible.
I'm
going to ask a question here because, again, I have a strong interest in trying to understand this a bit more. I mentioned a little while ago, as I look back on the struggle, of the participants in the struggle. It's always intriguing to me, who participated? And when I say that, I mean in terms of demographics here, and I try to look at the demographics of those participants in the struggle case. And as I examine that, as I said before, as I go back in history, I've always seen, it's predominantly blacks and other people of color as they do this, but there's always been that very, very small percentage of whites, and I always wondered, one, who are they? Why did they participate to that extent, putting their lives on the line and so forth? Why others stood by and said, I'm not going to participate? Why did they do it? So I have an interest in that thing. And why is the percentage so small? One thing I do know is when they do participate in numbers that are substantial, things change dramatically. It does make a big difference. That's what happened in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It happened in other countries. I studied Canada a lot, and I saw, again, you got the civil rights, whatever it is, there. That small percentage of whites who participate can make a difference. Who are they, and why do they participate? I have found some similarities across the board as a case. I was looking at the South Africa case when I wasn't so I was very pleased to see the Goldberg participate. One of them I did see in the case. The others, I don't know who they are, but again, it was very small. Very small. Why is it so small, is my question. I can only get an answer from those who I call free whites, and I don't know who they are, but since whether you are or not, but I'd like to have an answer to that question. Those who know why they participated and others did not, why? That's my question. It's a long-term research question I have, so I'm just trying to, you know.
I can only speak for myself, but I guess I feel like a lot of people want to reproduce themselves and want to reproduce, and I mean themselves in the sense of I want my kids to be like me, I want to have a society that's like me. And I find a lot of people aren't so interested in social change. It's more about how do I survive in this milieu and how do I help it move forward in a certain way. So. I mean, for me, I grew up in a very homogenous community, and the issue of gender was the first one that I was pissed off about, and then it was comments about race, even though it was almost every year all white students. Occasionally, a student of color or two would come, but of course, would leave, given that environment. But so I kind of, my own, I guess just anger and invisibility kind of manifested in that I wanted to do racial justice work. So it's about personal experience, and then also, I guess, when you talked about religion, Dr. Lim, being awake, because if you see these things as concepts that are mobilized, race is a concept that's mobilized, you can't deny any other's humanity. So how can you live with when people's humanity is consistently denied, and it's globally? It's not okay. So that's a really personal answer, but just wanted to share.
I think on that question very quickly that there were cases, and Peter Allegi gave a very good one of Bram Fischer, where someone can break through that barrier, of, in this case of Afrikanerdom. But in other cases, it's very historical, I think. One thinks of the influence of family, of kin, of peer groups, but also of established bodies. So whether it's the US or in other countries, the global anti-apartheid movement's components, we saw the wonderful mentoring of specifically anti-apartheid groups, the anti-apartheid movement. We saw the churches, many of the churches draw in the trade unions, as John mentioned earlier, that had built up over decades these traditions of solidarity. So I'm currently engaged in a comparative study of maritime workers with a professor in Illinois. He's looking at San Francisco maritime workers and South African solidarity, and I'm looking at the same in Australia. So there were these different bodies, the liberal groups in Western Europe, the political parties on the left, even sometimes a small minority of conservatives who joined in the global anti-apartheid movement. And then there was also the power of states, and comes back to Kurt's opening point about, yes, progress is being made in South Africa. So the solidarity of countries like India, which had recently won their freedom from hundreds of years of colonization, the solidarity of Nordic countries, Sweden in particular, solidarity of Caribbean countries, Jamaica and Cuba, other African countries, and then all the civil society groups in those countries, whether they're labor unions, churches, political parties, student bodies. Universities and students were particularly active in the 50s, the World University Student Movement. And when I got involved in the late 60s, early 70s, I was mentored, I was taught by student newspapers that, unfortunately, they don't exist on this campus. We have this silly corporate sort of thing, but we had really radical student newspapers which were talking about apartheid, which were talking about Vietnam. And so I think it was the same in Western Europe, it was in Latin America, that there was this passing on of the baton from an earlier generation of student activists to the next generation. And so the people who were active in the 40s and 50s, they then educated us so that when I became active in 69, 70, 71, they were already there organising things, and I just slotted into the troops. And so we shouldn't forget this generational mentoring that goes on. And you could apply it in African American struggles, Paul Robeson, but even before that, going back to the AME Church involvement in South Africa. There's quite a web of African American connections with South Africa, and that history is now being brought out. So I think we owe it to earlier generations to acknowledge that role. And so that some of those individuals, even with Bram Fischer, if he was honest to the principles of his grandfather as a jurist, then if you're honest to the Constitution, if you're honest to the principles of law, then how can you be anything but a revolutionary, as in the case of Mandela, who became a lawyer, or the founder of the ANC, Pixley Semi, who studied law at Oxford and in Columbia in New York. And so there's an inherent quality in things like the law that is built on principles. So if people are honest and consistent, then they can't help but become activists against racism.
It's easy to see the Mandela. Where is the white side of the Mandela is what I'm asking for. That was the piece I was asking for.
Well, there's plenty of them in South Africa, which we could talk about later.
That's what I was asking for. That other side of the fence, so to speak. For Mandela. He's not using it. What do you expect? Where is the other side of that? That's even Martin Luther King.
One could talk about George Bezos or Charles Wilson. Yeah. I mean, there are plenty
Martin Luther
of them.
King was pleading to his white fellow religious people, look, join me in the struggle. Join me in the struggle. These were religious people, so-called. Did they join in the struggle? No. Most of them did not. Very small percentage may have broken away. Why was that? Those are the questions that intrigue me, and I'm still trying to find answers to them. So I ask whenever I get an opportunity, why was the percentage so small?
Could
I think a question. A lot of white people just still do not understand that our own liberation is, as human beings, is tied to this. I just think we don't get it. We don't question the inextricable links between race and capitalism. We don't question what it has done to us. So it scares me. I mean, I see a lot of people who I just feel like are asleep.
I don't know if I need the mic. My voice tends to carry a bit. I think this whole thing has presented a lot of very valuable questions for me personally. And I know that early on there was several comments made about this idea of non-racialism in South Africa, and it makes me think about the concept of post-racialism here in America, and I would love to hear at a later date, obviously, some takes on, I guess, the parallels and the comparisons between those two ideas. But there's a quote from Martin Luther King I just became aware of very recently, where he said, "The leaders of conscience can't be bothered with seeking consensus, they have to build the consensus." And when we talk about some of the things that here, especially education and inequality and equity, and then also the idea that there is no singular black agenda, at least here in America anymore, I'd be curious to hear some takes about how that consensus is necessary, really, I think, to make some kind of progress can be built, and then I guess contrasting that against what's happening in South Africa, at least with them having a constitution that was obviously built on the idea that there was a consensus, like how the history on those two things, at least the timelines, really define these struggles independently and keep us from, I guess, conflating the two, which is what we wanted to be wary of, I guess, at the outset. Does that make sense? That's a lot of different thoughts.
Thank you. Anybody want to respond?
I just think that that's wonderful sentiments, and I agree with them, but I just think there's one contradiction there in reality and philosophically between consensus and what was earlier being talked about was why all these, the great overwhelming majority of these whites didn't get involved, either in South Africa or the US. And part of that is that consensus can also work the other way. As you were saying, consensus of just having an easy life, of not rocking the boat, of personal interests. So, you know, I've got a nice car and a nice job and a nice house, so why should I? I spent decades of my life shouting in the street at protests for Indigenous rights, South Africa, many other issues. And it was always trying to get that person to beep their horn, trying to get that person going by to stop and actually read a flyer, trying to jog someone's conscience sufficiently so that they would take action. And young people are doing it again today in different areas. But there is this problem of if you seek consensus too much, and it comes back to what I said earlier about the historic compromise and how much do you compromise and how much do you fight, for what you think is right, how do you get that balance right in your own life but also in society? And so consensus can also be used for, like Richard Nixon did, for the silent majority. So there was sort of a consensus there. So I think Martin Luther King is exactly right. You have to build a consensus, but you also need to build a movement that's powerful enough to challenge entrenched power, because they sure enough, they don't want the sort of consensus that Martin was talking about. They want that silent majority sort of consensus. So I think we've got to keep moving on those issues.
I would just say one of the things maybe in closing that we might just went through my mind as we were talking, which is that I remember when the night that Barack Obama was being elected, and a friend contacted us from South Africa who runs at the Iziko Museums in Cape Town, and she said that all of the workers that were the security guards who were up all night were listening to the radio of the broadcast of that election and how important that was to them and how she felt it was important that we knew that. And I think there's been this history of awareness back and forth. It is solidarity, it's also inspirational, it also works in many ways. I remember there's a wonderful photograph in the Detroit News front page photograph when Nelson Mandela arrived in the United States, remember, made his first tour. Some of you will remember this. And he came to Detroit. And he came off the plane, and he stood at the top coming down the stairs, and he said, "Where's Rosa Parks? I want to meet Rosa Parks." And she was there. And there's this great photo of them meeting. And so many of the people who were involved in the liberation movement of that era were reading and listening and learning and mindful of what was happening at a time when global communication isn't what it is today. But we can certainly carry that dialogue forward. And we identified some really great questions here today. Joe, we're going to keep yours in mind, certainly, but many others. And we didn't have a chance to talk of a lot of other arenas. There's a great deal going on in the realm of cultural heritage policy, of name changes of cities and streets, and what that means, and who participates in taking hold of heritage, or legacy and new legacy museums and institutions, and curriculum changes. But this is the beginning of that conversation. I thank you for coming out and joining it today. And could we have a round of applause for our terrific panel today?